doing better than ever. Ooh. It hasn't been that long.
No, it's not been very long at all.
Hi, I'm Bev.
And I'm Diz.
And this is
Trigger Warning.
And today we have a true crime case, as promised, because we would never break our promises unless we were slacking and didn't do our work. But we did our work this time. Yes, those kind of circumstances. But we didn't. We did our work and we are ready to go.
Oh, yeah.
And do we have any business we need to attend to? We need to say our email address.
Triggerwarning411@gmail.com.
That's right. Why are you saying it with a question mark at the end?
No. Like, use it. Talk
yeah,
to us.
Use it. Talk to
Send
us.
Send us an email. Yeah. Sorry, I'm clapping to get my point across.
She's clapping at us. Okay.
Yeah. Just, you know.
Do it.
Just do it, guys. We'd love to hear from you.
Yes. And then I guess I'm going to just get started with this
mess. Let's do it. I'm very excited.
Okay. So, for the trigger warnings for this episode today, we have murder. We have brief descriptions of the method of murder. Mm. We have brief descriptions of home invasion. And we have brief descriptions of stalking.
Have mercy. A little bit of everything.
Yeah. So there was a story on the local news about this. A man who lived in Quincy, Illinois, was going to be on an episode of the game show Family Feud.
Woo woo! Family Feud!
He and his parents and his brothers had traveled to L.A. in the fall of 2019 to record the episode, and it was scheduled to be aired on January 22nd, 2020. Quincy is a small town, so this was a big deal. The man's name was Timothy Bleefnik, and he told KHQA ABC News that it was a thrill to appear on the show. He told them about the fun that he and his brothers had with host Steve Harvey, and they were talking about their nice suits that they were wearing, and he was excited for people to see it, and he couldn't wait for the show to air. 2 days after the short news segment, the show aired, and some people in town got a good laugh at it. One of the Tim's answers on the show kind of made some eyebrows lift, but people thought it was kind of funny. When Steve asks, "Name a mistake you made on your wedding day," Tim looks kind of sheepish and says, "Honey, I love you, but saying I do." So the audience kind of gasps and they laugh, and Tim quickly says, "Not my mistake, not my mistake. I love my wife." And then he goes, "I'm going to get in trouble for that, aren't I?" Well, luckily for him and his team, the answer's on the board. It's actually the second most popular answer.
Oh.
Yeah. Timothy Bleefnik was born on April 26th, 1983. He grew up in Illinois with his two brothers, his mom and dad. He was well-liked in school and was considered bright and kind. His parents instilled a strong work ethic in him and his brothers. Tim was active in church and overall had a happy childhood. In school, he participated in clubs and other activities, including chess club and mathletes.
Wow.
He was also a member of the National Honor Society and was active in his church. After graduating high school, he attended Quincy University, where he played football and studied criminal justice. In 2019, he was inducted into the Quincy University Sports Hall of Fame for football.
Oh my gosh.
This is also where he met Rebecca Becky Postal. Becky was born November 19, 1981 in Quincy, Illinois. She was valedictorian of her high school, so she was obviously really smart and studious, but pictures of her show a beautiful smile and very kind eyes. Aww. She just looked, her smile was genuine. It just reached her eyes,
super
you could tell.
Wholesome lady.
Yeah. So at Quincy University, she earned a bachelor's degree in biological science with a minor in chemistry, and then she worked as a pharmaceutical sales rep out of college and was one of the most successful reps in her company.
Wow.
She and Tim got married on September 18th, 2009, while she was basically at the peak of her pharmaceutical career. But her family and friends said that she'd always imagined working in a more hands-on environment. So that's when she decided to go back to school and become a nurse. And Tim admits he didn't want her to go to school. He said he didn't like the idea of the pressure it would put on her. But Becky's family and friends said that he didn't want to lose control over her.
Oh, brother.
either way, Becky went ahead and pursued her dream. She attended Blessing Riemann or Riemann College of Nursing and Health Sciences and graduated from there. She also received the Faculty Outstanding Senior Award. And if that wasn't already impressive enough, she gave birth to her third son during spring break of her senior year and only missed one day of school.
Have mercy. What a couple. Like a yeah, power couple. Yeah.
She was badass.
Yeah, she was.
So she was obviously a strong and determined woman. So with her nursing degree under her belt, Becky worked for Quincy Medical Group in gastrointestinal surgery and then went to Blessing Hospital's emergency room. During the COVID pandemic, she worked at both Northeast Regional Medical Center in Kirksville, Missouri, and Hannibal Regional Hospital in Hannibal, Missouri, as a travel nurse. In 2020, she was nominated for the International Daisy Award, which honors exceptional care given by extraordinary nurses.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll see the signs up sometimes at the hospital here to nominate somebody. Becky was an RN. She was also a certified trauma nurse specialist and a sexual assault nurse examiner. In 2023, at the time of our story, she was working at Blessing Hospital in vascular access and was working toward her nurse practitioner certification.
Wow.
And this all sounds very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from someone who works in the medical field, I can tell you that it is really impressive.
For sure.
According to her family and friends, she was even more impressive as a mom.
Oh.
On the 48 Hours episode about this case, her sister said that Becky was, quote, born to be a mom. Everyone agrees that the most important part of Becky's life was always her three boys, and that she was a great, quote, boy mom.
Oh.
She threw herself into the boy stuff, like making a Transformer Halloween costume that actually transformed, or supporting her boys in sports, or frog hunting. She made sure that they knew that she was there for them and that she was devoted to them and devoted to making them her priority. But her friends said no matter how busy she was with work and her boys, she still made time for her friends and the rest of her family. And even through simple gestures, she let people know she was thinking of them.
She's like Wonder Woman.
Yeah. She would check in on a sick friend. She'd offer up a joke during boring tasks. She loved to laugh. She had a great sense of humor. She honestly just sounds like the kind of person that anybody would be honored to be friends with.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, all the pictures of her, she looks like such a kind person.
Aww.
And the smile that just goes to the eyes, you can tell when you can, when somebody's genuinely happy, you know? So at the time of this story, Tim and Becky had been married for 14 years and had their three sons. Mm-hmm. They lived together in a nice home in Quincy. Tim had been working at Quincy Recycling Plant for over 11 years in different roles and was also active in a local theater group. Becky, as I mentioned before, was working in a hospital and working toward obtaining her nurse practitioner certification. It was actually Tim that ended up filing for divorce on January 21st, 2021, citing changes in Becky's behavior. In his interview with 48 Hours, Tim said that Becky, quote, struggled with patience and stress a lot, especially when it came to the kids, and it created some conflict. Becky's sister Sarah said that Becky wanted to salvage the marriage at first, even suggesting marriage counseling, but Tim refused. Their divorce soon turned ugly, with arguments flaring up between the two over everything, including the house, finances, and custody of their boys. One of the other things that caused some contention was Tim's father, Raymond Bleithnick. There had been rumors and allegations from family members that Ray had been inappropriate with female children. Becky did not want her boys to be around Raymond unsupervised, obviously. Tim argued that their kids were boys, so there was nothing to worry about. So on May 9th, 2021, Becky texted a longtime friend saying this about Tim, quote, he told me if I outed his dad that he, Ray, the dad, would probably have to move, then kill himself. I absolutely think he will try to take the kids sometime. Talking about the dad. Facebook messages on June 4th with a former coworker reiterate fears about her children being left unsupervised with Raymond Bleithnick and her worry that he would run off with the kids. She did end up filing for an order of protection against Ray Bleithnick on December 16th, 2021, but a judge denied the request. Between Facebook and text messages, it sounded like Becky was in constant conflict with two of the men in her life that she should have been able to depend on.
Mm-hmm.
So while battling her concerns over her allegedly pedophile father-in-law, she was still dealing with the rage and abuse from her estranged husband. A couple of texts to her friends read, quote, "He has screamed in my face. He shoved me in front of the kids, and he has thrown things across the room." Another one said, quote, "I truly believe Tim has serious mental health problems, and he is becoming more vengeful and unpredictable." But Tim says that Becky was the vengeful one, claiming that she told people he was having an affair or that he was an alcoholic, both of which he says are not true. Eventually, Tim sought an order of protection, which is basically a restraining order against Becky, saying that she was stalking and harassing him. Like, she had time. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Uh-huh.
He cited an incident where he said Becky became, quote, combative during a disagreement at a parent-teacher night at the kid's school. And a note from me here, there is footage of this, I guess recorded on somebody's cell phone, that they showed on the 48 Hours episode, and neither of them sounded combative or acted combative on that. It looked like they sounded frustrated, but otherwise it just looked like two adults having an argument. Like, they weren't yelling even. They were just talking kind of, like, succinctly and kind of harshly. You know, that was it. Anyway. So, Becky texted her sister one day with the following statement. Quote, if something ever happens to me, please make sure the number one person of interest is Tim, as that is who would do something to me. I'm putting this in writing that I'm fearful he will somehow harm me, come after me, or will try to do something to me that takes me away from the kids or the kids away from me. He has already lied multiple times to paint himself as a victim and me as the perpetrator when it is absolutely the other way around. No, I have not sent this to Mom and Dad as I don't want them to be out of their minds with worry. End quote. According to her sister, the text was prompted by a colleague of Becky's, a nurse who was murdered by her partner. So she heard about this nurse that was murdered and it made it real, basically. So Sarah, her sister, urged Becky to go get help by reaching out to a domestic abuse organization.
Mm-hmm.
Becky did end up, after that, seeking an order of protection against Tim and explained that he had entered her residence without permission and repeatedly falsified interactions. Neither Tim nor Becky's orders of protection were granted. He didn't get his. She didn't get hers. Becky's friends and family think that the legal system saw her filing of the order of protection as gameplay. They're getting a divorce. He filed one. Now she's filing one, like, as retribution.
Unfortunately, it does happen, but yeah, that is an absolute shame.
Exactly. So,
of course, that doesn't mean it would have helped at all, but
at least
it's something.
Yeah. Well, in August of 2022, the judge did order the two of them both, to stay away from each other's residences, except when picking up or dropping off their kids. And he said even when exchanging the kids, they were to stay within 3 feet of their own vehicles, which would ensure them not getting too close to the other one's house.
Yeah.
So it was basically like, that way you can't get too close to each other. I guess. Because, you know. The judge also ordered Tim to return a 9mm handgun that Becky had given him when they were together. She had given it to him as a gift, but it was still registered in her name, so she said that she wanted it back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he ordered him, that makes sense, give it back to her. On January 5th, 2023, Becky ran into a friend of hers, Melissa Young, at a store in town. Melissa said that Becky looked exhausted, and after her asking her how things were going, Becky told her about the divorce. And then she told her that Tim had told Becky, "You'll be dead before you get any of my money." On February 13th, 2023, Becky's new boyfriend, Ted Johnson, arrived at her house around 11:45 that evening and spent the night. Becky and Tim's divorce was set to go to trial March 2023. Less than 1 week before the trial date, on February 23rd, 2023, Becky was murdered. About a week before their trial.
And about
9 days after her boyfriend spent the night at her house.
That's just fish.
When Becky got to her house on Kentucky Road around 12:30 p.m., around lunchtime on February 21st, 2023, she messaged Tim and asked if he could keep the boys for a couple of nights. She was recovering from an abdominal surgery. According to the 48 Hours episode on this case, Tim said that Becky asked if he could keep the kids an extra night because she wasn't feeling well. And I'm not sure if this was because of the surgery, and he had them for two nights or three nights or what.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find another source that said it was an extra night.
Yeah.
Or if it was just the two nights just originally that she asked him for because she was recovering or what. Either way, on the morning of February 23rd, 2023, so two days later, basically, at 6:45 a.m., another resident of Kentucky Road, Brian, left for work and noticed that Becky's front door was open. He noticed it. Apparently, he didn't do anything about it, but he was just like, oh, that's weird.
Mental note that her door was open.
Between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m., another resident of Kentucky Road, Amy, saw Tim bring a little Tykes basketball hoop to his dad's house. So I don't know if his dad also lived on that street or if he picked it up from Becky's house and took it there, but she lived on the same road as Becky.
Okay.
And she saw him sometime between 7 and 9 pick up this little Tykes thing and took it to his dad's house. I'm assuming his dad lived on that road, maybe, because otherwise how would she know where he took it? Anyway.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah. At 11:51 a.m., Tim called St. Peter's School and tells them not to let his kids walk home to Becky's house. At 1:50 p.m., which is 57 minutes before school lets out, Tim is seen on surveillance footage arriving at St. Peter's School. So he gets there an hour before school lets out. He's already called at noon, which is three hours, before school lets out, to tell them not to let them walk home. He gets there at 2, which is an hour before school lets out, basically. Then he texts Becky's dad at 3 o'clock, Bill Postal. He asks him to call Becky and find out when she's getting the kids because he claims that the school called him saying no one has picked up the kids. Well, you called the school and told them not to let them walk home. He was at the school at 2 o'clock, and now he's texting Becky's dad at 3 and saying, can you call Becky and find out why she hasn't picked up the kids? The school called me. So at 3:30 p.m., Bill goes and finds Becky dead at her house. She was 41 years old. Her dad immediately goes to the neighbor's house to use her phone to call 911. 3:33 p.m., the officer gets dispatched to her house on Kentucky Road. 4 p.m., the neighbor who let Becky's father use her phone goes and picks up Becky's mom, Bernadette, and she calls Tim, and he replies, what? Because they're letting him know that they found Becky, and she's dead. What? I guess the theater group worked for him.
For him, yeah.
At 7 p.m. that evening, her boyfriend, Ted Johnson, is questioned by the police and given a DNA swab test because they always look at the partner.
Did they look at her daggone husband?
They gonna.
Have mercy.
Yeah. So Becky's older sister, Sarah Riley, and her husband, Brett, were on vacation when they got the call that Becky was dead. They explained on 48 Hours, they explained the surreal feeling of packing in a hurry, flying back to New York where they live, swapping out their swimsuits for funeral clothes.
Oh my God.
Which gives me chills to think about. And then flying to Quincy, Illinois. Brett described Becky as selfless.
She just seemed like she was amazing.
She was, yeah. Sarah immediately pointed police in the direction her sister had instructed her to. To Tim Bleefnik.
Good job, Sarah.
Yeah. Becky had told him. Look at him. Yeah. So, police began their investigation at the crime scene itself, of course. Becky had been shot to death in the bathroom within, the master bedroom.
Okay.
15 shots had been fired.
Oh my gosh.
She had been hit 14 times. Only one bullet missed her.
That is called overkill.
Yes. The door to the bedroom had been kicked in. There was splintered wood laying on the ground. There were shell casings present from a 9mm handgun.
What?
What millimeter handgun was it that Tim Bleefnik had?
Was it nine?
Was it 9mm?
I think it was.
I think it was. They also found some strange pieces of colored plastic. And they were kind of like, what is this? We'll find out.
Interesting.
So the point of entry looked like a window to one of the boys' rooms. And it looked like it had been pried open. A partial shoe print was found on the carpet where the killer had entered.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing had been stolen. No other damage was done to the house. Becky had not been beaten or sexually assaulted. The person had come in, broken in that window, went to her, kicked the door in, shot her.
14 or 15 at her.
Tried to kill her. Yeah, tried to shoot her 15
hit her
times.
14 times.
14 times. And then just left.
Uh-huh.
With inexpensive and easy access to wireless cameras for security these days, it's become common practice for investigators to check for footage around the crime scenes.
Yes, it is.
So, in the case of Becky's murder, they didn't have to go far. Becky's neighbors, Taylor Hyman and his wife, had a security camera on the side of their house that was triggered by motion. They had had a break-in to their one of their cars, like, the year before. So they put a camera up on the side of their house.
Lovely.
And it pointed down their driveway. But it also, their driveway ran the length of Becky's house.
Okay.
They had a view of their driveway, but it also, like, anybody walking up their driveway, they knew could cross over to Becky's house easily.
Okay.
Back on Valentine's Day, February 14th, between the hours of 12 a.m. and 1 a.m., their camera had captured a person walking along their driveway. So in the middle of the night, somebody walks up their driveway. They thought it was a prowler looking for something to steal.
Yeah.
The wife had texted Becky, but Becky didn't respond to the text until the next morning. She said that she thought she had heard voices in her backyard, and she had noticed that the motion light had come on. And according to her neighbors, Becky had seemed, quote, paranoid.
Mm.
Now, keep in mind, that was the 13th at 11:45 p.m. was when her boyfriend came over.
That's right.
So he was there that night. So now, the night before Becky's murder, so February 22nd at 1:05 a.m., the camera recorded a person walking up their driveway again. So not the night she was murdered, the night before.
Okay.
In the early, early morning hours, 1:05.
Things.
So walked up the driveway at 1:05. 48 minutes later, the person was recorded walking back the opposite way. So the police continued to canvass the neighborhood, and detectives found additional footage from other homes and at the Quincy Bus Barn. And the Quincy Bus Barn is the, like, central hub where the school buses are housed for Quincy Public Schools.
Oh, okay.
So it's just a cool name for where they park the school buses.
That's funny. Bus barn.
Yeah. So what they found on that footage was really interesting. So combined with the recordings from Becky's neighbors is, like, really interesting. They discovered that each time that the neighbor's camera captured a person in their driveway, the bus barn cameras and the other houses that had cameras would record a person riding their bike along a route that would conceivably take them to Becky's house. Person was seen riding a bike past the bus barn and then turning onto Prairie Street. That path would take the person in the direction of Becky's house.
Okay.
Then the person on the bike was seen returning with the timestamps from the neighbor's house falling perfectly within that coming and going. So it was basically like, see them at the bus barn, they turn onto Prairie Street, that would give them the perfect amount of time to ride to Becky's house, walk up the driveway, come back at whatever time, ride the bike back, I'm gesturing wildly, ride the bike back, and be caught again on those other cameras going back the other way. Timestamps all lined up. And it was each time, like, the February 13th, or the 14th, and then the 22nd. They looked at the night of the murder itself, and the neighbor's camera did not have anybody in their driveway. But the bus barn did see the bike rider again. And he was going on his usual route. The person that was on the bike was headed towards Becky's house like normal and was on the return trip after the murder. And they know what time on the way because Becky had tried to dial 911 on her cell phone.
Really?
Yeah. She basically at 1:11 a.m., they found her cell phone behind the bedroom door with 91126 on the dialer where she was trying to hit the buttons, which, like, that's heartbreaking.
That's so sad.
Yeah. So she had tried to call at 1:11 a.m. The camera showed the bike rider before 1:11 a.m. and then going back the other way after 1:11.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem with the video evidence from both the neighbors, the bus barn, and the other houses was that none of it showed any detail.
Right.
It was in the middle of the night and shades of black and white and gray.
Right.
No detail of the person's face or clothes, except he might be wearing gloves. The bike couldn't be identified. No make or model or color, except that it didn't look like it had any kind of reflectors on the wheels. That's all they could really tell. Every detective knows, as well as every true crime listener, that the first person that is suspected is the husband or boyfriend or partner.
Yes.
So as I mentioned before, Becky's new boyfriend, Ted, had been DNA swabbed the evening of the murder.
Uh-huh.
But Sarah had told the police about Becky and Tim's divorce and Becky's fear of Tim.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, they were going to look at him. And it's interesting, too, that Tim only lived about a mile from Becky and in the same direction that would have made sense for the bicyclist's route.
Interesting.
On February 27th, an abandoned men's blue Schwinn bike was found less than a block from Tim's home near the Quincy bus barn. And like the bike in the video, it had no reflectors on the wheels. Other than that, the police couldn't say it belonged to Tim. There was no DNA on it, nothing that linked it to Tim.
Oh, wow, really?
But it was just close to his house, and they're like, well, it doesn't have reflectors. It could be the bike. It could be completely random. There's nothing that they could say was his. On March 1st, 2023, the police did a search of Tim's house. And so for this part, I'm going to tell you what they found, what the investigators and the prosecutors think it proves, and what Tim's attorney says about it, and you can decide what
think about it. Oh my gosh, I can't wait. Okay, yeah. I'm okay. Ready. Lay it on us.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
So, in their search, they looked for shoes that could have left the partial shoe print found at the scene.
Love it. Okay.
He had several pairs of shoes, but none that matched the print.
Darn.
But Quincy, Illinois is a town on the Mississippi River, so I don't think it would be hard to get rid of some shoes.
Good point.
They searched for the 9mm gun that Tim was supposed to return to Becky, but never had returned. Because remember, Becky had been killed with a 9mm.
Right.
No 9mm gun was found.
Give her the gun back. Yeah.
He never gave it back to her. No 9mm gun was found. But Quincy, Illinois is a town on the Mississippi River, so I don't think it would be hard to get rid of a gun.
Agreed.
Shell casings were found at his home, 27 of which would end up matching the ones found at the crime scene. Tim's lawyer says that the analysis of this evidence can be a matter of, it can be subjective to human error.
How so?
I guess one person can look at the markings on it and think it matches, and one person can say it doesn't. I don't know. Mm. They found a crowbar that could have been the one to use to pry open the kid's window.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an expert look at the tool marks, but they said, because they're honest, that they could not say with 100% certainty that it was the tool that was used, because they can't.
Yeah.
They can't do that.
Right.
They found stacks of Aldi bags, the grocery store chain.
Yeah.
Which matched the pieces of the plastic that were found at the crime scene.
Oh my gosh. So, what the heck?
Investigators and prosecutors think that Tim tried to use them to either muffle the gunshots or to catch his shell casings. The bags had DNA that was more likely to belong to Tim or a descendant of his than to anyone else. But Tim's lawyer said that everyone in Quincy has Aldi bags that they're hoarding.
And Tim goes around and touches all of them.
And as for the DNA, the killer could have gotten a bag from Becky's own house, Or she said they could have, like, they swap things out for the kids all the time in Aldi bags. So it could be his DNA or it could be the kid's DNA that the killer grabbed one of the bags and that's why their DNA's on it. Becky had DNA under her fingernails too, but it was the same story. It's Tim or one of his descendants. So Tim's lawyer's like, it could be from one of the boys. No bloody clothes were found. No gloves were found in Tim's house. Okay. But Quincy, Illinois is a town on the Mississippi River, so I don't think it would be hard to get rid of bloody clothes or a pair of gloves.
I agree.
Prosecutors also pointed out that Becky's killer passed by two windows before finally choosing the window of a child who just happened not to be there that night. And that's especially important if it was an extra night that the kid was staying.
Yeah.
Because they were staying the two nights. If it was an extra night and she had just said, can you keep them one more night for me?
Mm-hmm.
Then he was probably the only one that knew that.
Yeah.
But if it was still, I mean, even if it was two nights, like, yeah, they passed by her window, like the person who was, they were going in there to kill, passed by the window, passed by like another kid's window, went to the third window and opened that window.
Interesting.
Yeah. His lawyer thinks that the police never looked into the idea that it could have been a break-in gone wrong and that there had been break-ins in the neighborhood in the weeks leading up to the murder. But prosecutors disagree. Prosecutor Josh Jones says, quote, it wasn't a random prowler. It was an execution. You don't kick down a door, chase them into a bathroom, shoot them once, then shoot them that many more times in a random act.
And then you don't even
and then
steal
don't
something?
Steal anything.
That's ridiculous.
Don't steal anything. Don't assault her. Don't, like, what was the point of going in there just to shoot her 14 times?
We know exactly what the point was now.
So, when Tim's laptop and cell phone are searched, some really interesting things are found.
Do love those search histories.
Yes, we do. So, there are pieces of evidence here that are time-stamped and occurred on different electronics. So, it's kind of hard to explain without telling them in a timeline format.
Go for it.
So, I'm going to take the partial timeline from earlier, which was from WGEM News.
Okay.
And I'm going to fill in the rest of the information with the technology-related evidence.
Love it.
So, this evidence comes from Tim's laptop, his cell phone, and a Whoop band. Whoop, W-H-O-O-P band. It's a Fitbit-ish kind of, like, band
that
monitors, like, sleep and heart rate and stuff that you, you know, that one of those things that connects to your smartphone.
Fantastic.
So, based on the evidence found, this is the timeline of events as laid out by Quincy WGEM News. I sounded like an anchor.
Totally sounded like a legit anchor.
I know. August 2022, the judge orders that Tim and Becky have to stay within 3 feet of the cars when exchanging the kids and cannot go into the other person's residence. He also says Tim must return the 9mm gun to Becky. October 10th, 2022. Tim uses his cell phone to contact a man via a Facebook account under the name John Smith about a blue 26-inch men's Schwinn mountain bike.
Shut your valve.
The picture of the bike, which they find, is exactly like the one they found abandoned less than a block from his house at the Quincy bus barn. Tim also contacts a woman via Facebook under his own account, I assume, because they didn't say it was under John Smith's account, about a black mongoose bike for sale, and he purchases this one. They don't say that John Smith purchases the blue one, but I think he was thinking he was being smart. I think he bought the black mongoose bike under his own account, so they could say, well, you bought this bike, you know, and then he could say, but the bike that was used by that person was blue, and I bought a black bike.
Right. But,
and then bought the blue bike, or the blue bike under John Smith.
Under John Smith.
Like they couldn't figure out he was John Smith. Anyway. Okay. So then February 10th, 2023, Tim calls the Quincy Police Department to ask them if they will give Becky her 9mm handgun back. Because he says he doesn't want to give it to her face to face. They decline the request. Side note. On 48 hours, he said in his interview with them that he hadn't seen that gun in 3 years. So why would he call the cops and ask them about giving it back to her if he claims he didn't have it and hadn't seen it for 2 or 3 years at that point?
Because he's a bad liar.
Yeah.
It's hard to remember all those lies.
February 13th, so 3 days later, Ted Johnson, Becky's new boyfriend, arrives at her house at 11:45 p.m. and stays the night. February 14th, 2023, Valentine's Day, 12 a.m. Tim's Whoop Band loses connection and his phone is locked. Between 12 a.m. and 1 a.m. on February 14th, video surveillance detects a bike rider going past Quincy Bus Barn, past a residence at 224 South 20th Street, and back. Becky's next-door neighbor receives an alert about movement in the driveway. 1:10 a.m. to 1:30 a.m., Tim's laptop search history shows searches for, quote, license plate lookup, title registration lookup, VIN check lookup, vehicle records, and the search for Ted Johnson's exact VIN and license plate number. There are over 200 searches for these. Also, around this time, his Whoop Band reconnects. 1:32 a.m., a phone call is made to the Missouri Department of Revenue, which handles vehicle registrations. So it sounds like he rode his bike over to Becky's and was like, whose vehicle is this?
Yeah.
Then drove back to his house and started searching for VIN numbers and license plates. His lawyer. The interview with the lawyer just astounds me. His lawyer said, well, if it was me, I'd be looking it up late at night after the kids went to bed, too. Like, you're missing the point.
What the actual heck?
He shouldn't even know the dude is there.
Yeah.
He's there. The kids are at his house, I'm assuming. I don't know.
They're supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming if she has the man over to the house, that he's probably got the kids that night.
Yeah. Because
they're doing every other week. That's how the judge ended up having it at that point before the trial, was they were sharing custody a week on, week off with each one. Anyway.
So dumb.
Yeah. February 15th, 2023, the divorce trial date is set for March 3rd. February 21st, 2023, 12:45 a.m., Tim's Whoop Band disconnects. 12:45 a.m. to 2:11 a.m., the Quincy Public Schools Bus Barn video surveillance shows a bicycle rider southbound on 20th Street, then going east on Prairie Street. And additional footage captures the bicycle rider heading north on 20th Street between those hours. 2:11 a.m., so at the end of that range of time, his Whoop Band reconnects. 12:30 p.m. on the 21st, so that afternoon, Becky comes back home from her friend's house where she had stayed after her surgery.
Right.
She asks him to keep the kids for a couple of nights while she recovers. February 22nd, 12:42 a.m. So this is the night before the murder.
The murder, okay.
Tim's Whoop Band disconnects. 12:42 to 2:19 a.m. Video surveillance again shows the bike rider going southbound past the Quincy Bus Barn, turning east on Prairie. A person is captured on the neighbor's camera on the side of their house. The bike is recorded going back the other way sometime later. 2:19 a.m., Tim's band reconnects. 2:22 a.m., Tim's phone unlocks. And finally, the night of the murder, beginning just after midnight on February 23rd, 2023. 12:28 a.m., Tim's phone locks. 12:36 a.m., Tim's armband, Whoop Band, disconnects from his phone. 12:55 a.m., video of the bike rider riding southbound past the Quincy Bus Barn. 12:57 a.m., video shows the bicyclist turning east on Prairie. 1:11 a.m., Rebecca tries to call 911, and her phone's found behind the bedroom door later. 1:12 a.m., an ADT front door alert said the front door was opened, because they have the security system. 1:16 a.m., the video shows a bicycle rider heading northbound past the Quincy Bus Barn. 1:27 a.m., another ADT alert said the front door is still open. 2:01 a.m., Tim's Whoop Band reconnects. 2:07 a.m., Tim's phone unlocks. 6:45 a.m., the Kentucky Road resident Brian leaves for work and notices Becky's door is open. between 7 and 9, Amy sees Tim delivering the basketball hoop to his dad's house. Keep in mind, Becky doesn't want the kids around his dad.
Yeah.
Unsupervised especially, because of his dad's history, or supposed alleged history.
Uh-huh.
The prosecutors think that Tim went ahead and took the basketball hoop over there because he knew that Becky wasn't a problem anymore. His lawyer says, oh, well, the kids could still see their grandfather. They just couldn't see him without supervision. So him taking the basketball hoop there is not a big deal. That's not a sign he knew Becky was dead. What are the odds?
Exactly.
Also, he was keeping the kids. Why is he leaving 3 kids at home alone while he goes and does that?
Yeah, it's like, you have to.
It's like, why don't you take the kids with you? Although, I guess they were in school, whatever.
They all fit on that bike.
I guess they went to school anyway, because he then calls the school at 11:51 and says, don't let them walk home to Becky's house. I guess he doesn't want his kids to see her dead body.
How kind of them.
1:50, he goes to the school, which is 57 minutes before the end of the school day. 3:03, he texts Bill Postal, Becky's dad, and asks that he call Becky to find out when she's getting the kids, because the school supposedly called him and said no one's picked up the kids yet.
Does he not think these things can be confirmed?
Right. 3:30, Bill finds his daughter. February 27th, the abandoned bike is found. March 1st, the search is done of Tim's house. March 23rd, Timothy Bleefnik is arrested on 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of home invasion.
That is what I'm talking about.
March 24th, he pleads not guilty. His divorce attorney is now his defense attorney.
Just because you can do one doesn't mean you're going to be good at the other.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. His trial began in May 2023. All the evidence I just went over, I know it was a lot of times and stuff, but with that timeline is where you really see those numbers if you just line it up.
Well, yeah.
And I'll have in the show notes, I'll have the link to the WGEM
like
TV.
Like visual type?
Yeah, the actual timeline. Yeah. They also have a map showing of the bicycle route.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, he's like, his house is like a mile away.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like reading a book. It's like, yeah, this time, this time, this time, and then boom, he's back the other way. Like,
that is crazy.
Anyway, so they gave all that evidence. They included the picture of the bike he inquired about, posing as John Smith. And the photo of the bike that was abandoned. They showed the jury the video evidence of the bike rider and the time lining up on the cameras with the route and all that. They showed the evidence of the online searches that Tim had made that weren't included in the timeline because we aren't sure when he actually did them. We just know the only one we really know about was that night he did the VIN number lookup and stuff.
Right. Yeah.
But like the ones he did that I'm going to tell you about. I didn't include them in timeline because we don't know when he actually made these, but the searches included, quote, how to open my door with a crowbar, quote, how to make a homemade pistol silencer, and quote, how to clean gunpowder off your hands. On May 31st, 2023, Tim was found guilty on all counts.
Yay!
On August 11th, 2023, he's sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Yay!
Tim's lawyer says the police got it wrong, but when the prosecution rested their case and the defense had their turn to call their own witnesses, they didn't call anybody. And so the 48 Hours episode I watched, they were like, why didn't you call your own expert to contest the evidence and stuff, especially like with the shell casings? And Tim's lawyer said, I guess we could have, but we are strapped on time and funds. And she kind of shrugs. And so Aaron Moriarty, the 48 Hours correspondent, yeah, said, but you had a man's life on the line. And Tim's lawyer said, uh-huh, and he didn't want us to do that.
That's crazy. Heck?
Yeah, I don't know. In November 2024, Tim's appeal was denied by the appellate court. In December 2024, they filed a request for the Illinois Supreme Court to hear their appeal. They denied that in February 2025, and a request for reconsideration was immediately filed. If they reconsider, it'll only mean that they will review the request for the appeal, but they could still refuse to hear the appeal. At least that's what I think I figured out from what I read.
That sounds like that's what that is.
So, what did the Family Feud thing have to do with this?
Oh, I totally forgot about the Family Feud thing.
The answer.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. The episode he was on was recorded in 2019.
Right.
About 2 years before he filed for divorce, so they were probably still pretty happy at that point.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutor said, quote, it brought attention to the case, but it had nothing to do with it. And Tim's lawyer said, quote, it was a silly answer to a silly question on a silly show. And I think that's the first time I agreed with her.
I think you're right.
And that's the story of the murder of Becky Bleefnik.
Have mercy.
Yeah. Insane.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
And obsessive.
I mean, he, like, y'all have got to look up the timeline for that. Especially if you were, like, trying to follow all the numbers and stuff. Because I know, like, all the AMs and the dates and stuff got to be a lot. But if you actually, like, watch it laid out like that, it's, like I said, it's like reading a book.
Yeah.
Because the route that he takes and the times just line up perfectly. And then the neighbor's camera picks him up and then he goes back the other way and it just lines up perfectly. It's just like he just wrote a story with a bike.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
And then he's doing this because court's happening and he knows.
And it's so dumb too because like he's on Facebook on his own phone with a separate account under John Smith and looks at a bike. And then he abandons the bike near his own house.
Thank goodness for stupid criminals.
And you know what? I was looking at the map, because the map in that article from WGEM that has the timeline and has the route that the bicyclist could have taken.
Yeah.
Is actually one that you can, like, interact with and move it around. It's like an actual Google map.
Fun.
So I moved it over, and I didn't, like, measure exactly, but I think he's roughly maybe a mile and a half or 2 miles from the Mississippi River. And I'm like, you couldn't have biked down there and tossed it in? I mean, I'm glad he didn't.
Yeah, like...
You know, like... but it's like, what... Like, where did you put the gun and the shoes? Like, why did you just... Okay, I'm going to hop off this bike now and leave it here. No, that's not my bike. That's John Smith's bike, so it's fine. I bought a Black Mongoose bike.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about, man.
Crazy.
I got the mongoose.
Yeah. I think all the evidence points to him.
I think it's obvious that it's him.
And I don't even have to say allegedly because he's been convicted now.
That's right.
So.
Wow. It's nice to have
the Now, I will say that when watching the 48 Hours, his divorce attorney was very dedicated to her client. So much so that I am not saying that there's anything going on there. But I wouldn't be surprised, allegedly, if something allegedly was going on there.
In Quincy, Illinois is a town
that's very close to the Mississippi River. She just...
Yeah, that seems...
I don't know. She was a divorce attorney, and now she's his... She was his criminal defense attorney.
Can you do that? Like, that's... I don't understand how that works.
Yeah, either, I don't... Could I don't
she
know.
I guess she can.
Yeah.
But like,
I guess
that doesn't make any sense.
I thought that most of the time they were kind of like doctors and they specialized in a specific type of law.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what they focused on. Like they probably could do other types.
That's what she should have been focusing on was something other than that.
I mean, I figured that that's what they kind of like that they can do other types, but.
Oh, and then we could
like if you went to a corporate lawyer and was like, "Can you defend me in a criminal case?" They'd be like. I have no experience with that.
Or for a divorce, it's like, that's not what I know.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess if you're a lawyer for that state, then you can defend or whatever.
Yeah, you can do anything. Yeah.
For anything, I guess, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you should hire that one.
Yeah.
Guess he found that out the hard way.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I probably shouldn't have said that.
And those boys lost their mom. That's so sad.
Yeah. And they're being raised by her parents.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say his, and I was like,
No. No, her parents are raising them. But, I mean, she had so many friends and so many people that just loved her. And she was just, I mean, the pictures of her, she just looked like she was an amazing person. And all the education and stuff that she had.
And he knew he was going to lose that course hearing.
Yeah.
So he was like.
I mean, and the thing is, he had a good job. he wasn't, like, violent with the kids. He seemed like he was a decent dad. He just, they didn't get along, and, like, he was the one that asked for the divorce.
People co-parent all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to like the person anymore.
Yeah.
You do it for your kids.
And, I mean, like, he was making more money than she was. Like, even if, you know, I mean, they were fighting over the house and everything. But he was the one that asked, like, that filed for the divorce.
Yeah.
So, it's like, don't, what is the issue
here? I wonder what his end game was. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know.
Like, what really was he hoping
to accomplish?
What did he want the future to look like?
Right.
Like, obviously he was going to have his boys, which is, okay.
Yeah.
So, like, what
did when he filed for divorce, did he think, okay, well, she'll just let me keep the house and have the boys, and then she can go, what, live in an apartment somewhere?
And she can pay me.
Yeah, like, what? I don't know what he was thinking.
I don't know. Well,
and I'm not saying that they should stay in a marriage if they're not happy, but...
Right.
But he apparently wasn't interested in saving the marriage because he wouldn't do counseling, so he had to know that she would still want, you know, to have the boys, or, you know.
Yeah.
Like, he was asking for him to have 60% custody and her to have 40 so he could get child support from her and stuff. And it's like, what? I don't get it.
I mean, people get real, like,
they do.
And,
yeah.
In situations like
yeah.
that.
But, anyway.
Wow, what a story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad it ended, not that she died, but that the end for him was the way it is.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad that they were able to find the evidence they needed to put him away. Because if he'd gotten away with it, that just is not cool.
No. I mean, I remember hearing about this because they were talking
because
about
the Family Feud
thing.
Yeah. Well, it's like really... it's like the prosecutor said. It had nothing to do with it, but it did bring attention to it.
And the fact
because
that
of what
that
he said.
Question
yeah.
and his answer
yeah.
was very...
Yeah. He was basically like, I'm going to get in trouble for this, aren't I? You know, and they were laughing about it. And it was funny. Like, it was
yeah.
a silly question and it was a silly answer, but it was the number two answer. I was like, yeah, it's something
like
I probably would have said.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny.
And it would have been nothing had
yeah.
nothing else happened.
Right. Yeah. If nothing
them.
Had ever happened or they have just had a divorce and like a normal couple and everything was, you know, normal, it wouldn't
Most
have been a big deal.
People wouldn't even remember that episode of
no.
the Family Feud.
No.
Maybe they remember that answer because it is funny.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you in trouble now.
Yeah. yeah. But, it wasn't anything that was special enough to be
right.
to be that memorable, and it was just amusing, and...
It wasn't really a sign that things were bad, and he was
right.
already thinking
yeah.
about killing her or
right.
whatever. That wasn't the situation.
And, I mean, when it aired in January of 2020, well, things kind of went to shit in March of 2020. People would have forgotten about it.
Well, that's true.
I mean, everybody would have been like, What's Family Feud? We've all got COVID. I don't
right.
you know.
Stuck inside, we got the COVID.
Yeah. They were watching Family Feud, I guess, when they were stuck inside, but
rerun.
Yeah. She was too busy, you know, saving
making,
lives while he was
well, yeah, she's having to work a bunch.
Yeah. Well, he was, you know, big whiny boy.
Quarantining herself or whatever.
Yeah. So anyway, that is the story of Becky Bleefnik. Not the story
mercy.
Of him because I don't care
yeah,
about him.
Faces.
And so y'all can reach out and let us know what you think about him. And
yes, please let us know what you think.
Let us know if you would have answered the question with that answer, because I think I probably would have.
I mean,
and I would have been hilarious about it.
I totally get the answer.
I would not have killed my spouse
right.
a few years later.
No.
But that's because I'm not a moiterer.
That's right.
Okay. Well, we will catch you guys on the flip side.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks for sticking in there with me with the timeline thing. And
yeah.
you can check the sources out in our post on the notes and the thing. Yeah, that's the thing
the
I'm thinking
notes.
About. Yeah, the show notes. Thanks. Sorry, that was a lot of words I just said, so I can't do any more words.
They got you all crooked over here.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And also, guys, watch for deer.